Station number 12707, Captain Frank Brewis, reel 16.
Captain H.C.F. Brewis, Reel 16. Was the brigade organized into a combined gun light tank unit?
Yes, we were still 35th Independent Tank Brigade at this stage. Though the camp was shared with 152 RAC, they were the 11th Battalion of the King's Liverpools. Well, they were organised the same way as we were, you see, having been an infantry unit with four companies. They had to reorganise and absorb one of their companies into three squadrons, and they were working in parallel with us.
Do you know the organisation with regard to the way in which the tanks were organised? In that, did you have a complete squadron of lights, or did you have a mixture of lights and guns
It was on a squadron basis. What would that be? I cannot honestly remember. Within a squadron, what was the proportion of CDL tanks to gun tanks, and I cannot honestly at this stage remember. I would think probably half and half, but that's a semi-intelligent guess.
Were the men excited by this new weapon, and the way in which they saw it being used? Did it lift morale? Did people think,
Oh yes. I don't think they took kindly to the censorship. Not that anybody tried to break it, but I think it took a bit of getting used to that. Let us to the nearest and dearest were being read by their troop and squadron officers before they went off. I think possibly it might have sugared the pill a bit if A squadron's letters had been censored by B or C squadron's officers and kept switching around so they didn't know, and made it a little less personal, but it didn't happen. There was also the fact that this meant night work. And in the Lake District, with the rainfall that was normal there, the only thing about the night work was that it got them away from the dreadful conditions in the camp. It usually meant going out mid to late evening, and very often being out there till dawn. But the camp was in a hell of a state. It was partly tinted and partly hutted, but it was an absolute quagmire. And they did get a Ministry of Works flying squad, so called, in. They might have been flying in the sense that they arrived quickly after they'd got the orders, but oh crikey, the progress of swapping tents for huts was a long drawn out process. It went on for the better part of a year. Eventually we did get to be an all hutted camp, and proper paths and roadways laid down. The tank parks with their hard standings was the driest part of the whole setup.
Did this cause resentment, particularly between those living in the huts and those having to live in the tents in these appalling conditions?
Oh, a lot of belly aching went on about that, but I think you'd have got that in any unit in those circumstances. I don't know whether there was any swapping round or not. I don't think so. I think if you got the dirty end of the stick and had a tent, you were just happy for the times when it didn't blow away. We had a good naffy, a very good naffy. And something I haven't mentioned from the outset, we were a unit that was mad keen on sport. And there was one match that raised spirits sky high. We had a number of professional footballers from first division downwards. We had a fella called Morris who played for Manchester United. We had another fella from Tottenham. But anyway, at Penrith, we played the RAF at Blackpool. And who was the post corporal at Blackpool? None other than Stanley Matthews. And big Jock Dodds was a Scottish international. He was their centre forward. And it was a damn good match. They beat us, but only 2-1. But that brought a big civilian crowd in at Penrith. We played quite a number of inter-service matches and a lot of a variety of sports. Maybe I can deal with that separately. But from the morale point of view, in spite of the conditions, don't forget that people were going away on courses at various times, so that it wasn't all these vile conditions all the time.
Were you sleeping on the ground in the tents?
I honestly don't know. I was in a hut. I had a damn good batman. Also, I nearly didn't have him. He liked a jar. Did old Ward, and he'd been up at Clifton where our brigade headquarters was, and he'd come across the fields, and there was a rather rickety footbridge across the river, because we were right down by the river Eden, yes, I think so, right on the edge, and he missed it and went into the end of the river, and I don't think he'd ever swum in fresh water before, and certainly not in full battle dress. But he did manage to get out.
What were the food conditions like in the camp? Were you getting good rations?
Yes, by and large. There were odd occasions when the cook in the officer's mess went a bit mad. I remember one occasion when we had stewed sheep's heart for breakfast one Sunday, which didn't exactly go down very well. But going around as orderly officer, grub wasn't at all bad, really. And I think I've said on occasion that driving practice in a scout car troop often landed us to farms to pick up a few eggs and so on, and the bods in the scout car troop, I think, used to make a bit on the side by flogging their share to some of their mates to supplement the rations. typical army food, of course, cooked in quantity, bags of it. But one thing I could never understand, we used to love army cocoa, especially after coming in after a night training. But a lot of the other ranks didn't want it at all. They wanted good, strong Sergeant Major's tea. That involved the cooks as well, you see, because they had to get used to a different routine. And they had to be pretty nippy to have scalding hot dixies of either cocoa or tea to drink when the bods landed back. And it could be a bit elastic, but it was usually not long after dawn. So the cooks were on night duty as well as everybody else.
Being on duty through the night, was there some form of rest during the day?
For the bods who'd been out on exercise, and it would usually be in the early days, it was on a troop basis. But then, for the greater part of the time, on a squadron basis. So it wasn't the whole unit that was going around bog-eyed in the early morning. But it was taken in turn and kept till about midday. And then for the time they were on, it was pretty hectic because turn out and get everything tickety-boo for the next night. Can't think of anything more. One thing that did boost morale, the brigadier took it upon his own shoulders to say, right, come Christmas, 4 days leave. Virtually for everybody, it's just a skeleton staff left behind. And I think everybody very much appreciated that gesture.
How did that equate with the fact that this was a highly secret concern and you had a pretty strict security, and yet you're sending people all out on leave who had information which would be very exciting to certain ears?
Well, from the outset, I'm repeating myself here, but from the very outset, when it was known that we were going to change over and become a specialized unit, it was so drummed into people that their own lives and the lives of many others would depend on them keeping their mouth shut. And that if there were questions asked when they got home, but what were they doing? Well, they were training with a variety of tanks, because there weren't all that many tanks about yet, although tank production was creeping up. And it was necessary to be able to handle different types of tanks.
You got
that under censorship, and it wasn't one sort of lecture from the CO at the outset. You know, it was an ongoing process. And I mean, they knew this. They saw the blue cap military police on duty in the camp, and I think everybody respected it.
Had you, as officers, to sign any official secrets documents?
I can't recall that we did. I think we were put on our honour to. To keep it under a hatch. Or buried, shall I say.
You went on leave, you say, Christmas. How did your family receive you after being away for so long?
We'd had regular leaves as well.
And how regular were they?
Dependent on the state of the training, whether, you know, I said squadron basis, and there'll be two waiting their turn to be on the training area and so on. So in those sort of periods, there could be 7-day passes and 48-hour passes. I don't recall that Christmas. I think I must have been on the skeleton staff. Christmas 42. No, I think I must have been one of those left behind. CO didn't go. I think the adjutant went now. I'd been assistant adjutant, so not that there was a hell of a lot to do then at that stage.
What were your duties at this stage with all this training that was going on around you? Obviously you were involved yourself, as you've already said, but you had other duties as well.
I think it was during this stage that I went on the intelligence course to Cambridge and came back and organised a small intelligence section as a result of that course. In between times, relieving the adjutant, attending courts martial here, there and everywhere.
Were any of these to do with men in your own unit?
No, there were outside ones. I don't think that was a policy. I think the body was marched in, saw strange faces, purposely. We're a very invidious position to be in, to agree to a sentence of 28 or 27 days detention and in a glass house, and then potentially have that bod driving your tank when he came back.
What was discipline like within the unit?
Pretty good. Pretty good. In, when was it? 1985. Some of the bods who'd been in the orderly room started on their own to organise reunions. And Daddy Heslop sent a letter to be read out at the reunion. I didn't know about it then. As a result of that reunion, they found me, and I've been going to them ever since. But I've got a copy of that letter, and Dad Heslop said then, he said there never was a moment when they gave him any fears about the secrets that they all had to hold. I take it that he never had to discipline anybody. I think I mentioned that there were people in the intelligence corps doing a variety of jobs to pounce on anybody who got a bit careless. And when I was at the brigade, I shared a room with the intelligence officer in charge of that section. But he was looking back when he was nearly 90 when he wrote that letter. He died in the January of the next year, actually, when he, just after he reached 90.
Did you have any men who deserted?
Oh, I can't remember any desertions. I can remember absences without leave.
Were there many of those?
Well, we had a few hard nuts like any unit. It's part of the general picture. It's no use looking at it with rose-coloured spectacles. We had some of the best and we probably had some of the worst. But I think we were fortunate by virtue of the fact that there had been a variety of forms of weeding out. We had, I won't say the brighter ones, but the ones who showed some aptitude to be in a tank unit, as drivers, gunners, wireless operators, what have you. There'd been a sorting out of numbers. The lower war establishment had been a further minor sorting out against those who suffering from night blindness. So it obviously it didn't leave us with a unit of angels, but broadly speaking, not too bad.
Do any men stand out in your mind as being other than angels?
Yeah. What the hell was his name? He was not that it mattered. It did matter in infantry days. He could never get away with the light infantry pace. He would. What the devil was his name? He was always in some sort of trouble. And then it was Charles Beaudry, who decided to try something different with him. And he brought him into the officer's mess as a bottle washer. Oh, and he thought that was great. And of course, he fed a little bit better probably as well, you know, on the remainders. And it lasted quite well.
Were there any officers?
Until Charles Beaudry went into the officer's mess kitchen and found him drying the dishes on a very grubby army vest of his. It didn't last long. There was, that somebody had it in for the Prevost sergeant. We never found out who it was, but it was a terrible thing they did. They wound down the dampers on the suspension on his motorbike so that it was almost solid and almost impossible to steer. But of course, as soon as he got on, he tumbled to it. Could have been nasty. Could have been very nasty.
Were there any officers who, in time, proved to be less competent than you all were expected to measure up to?
Well, at the time of the changeover from infantry to tanks, that became apparent. And we said goodbye to a few. The second in command that we'd had in the early days, Major Harwood, it was ex-territorial 9th Battalion, territorial reserve, called back from the reserve. And he was a good infantry, pretty good bloke, but he'd knocked on a bit. And he was replaced by Malcolm Dees, Royal Tank Regiment, second in command. Can't think of any particular individuals who didn't pull their weight. there were occasions when people did skive off a bit. I suppose they said that about me when I was out on the egg hunt. Sorry, when I was having scout car driving practice.
Did you lose any men through accidents or illnesses, diseases?
There were a number of accidents, fortunately none of them serious. There was one much later on, there was a fella crushed between two tanks. And there was another fella, I had to go to his funeral in Gateshead. They sent me because he was ex-Durham's and I was from the area. But it was purely fortuitous. He great big tall fella. He was in the MI room, part of a course of injections. And he was like the fella ahead of me on the steps at Dunbar. He keeled over and fractured his skull, and he died from it.
Do you call his name?
No. No. I took half a dozen bods up. Oh, dear me. What's his name? No, it's gone. That would be about sometime in 44, I think. Yeah, it would be.
Was there much opportunity to meet the opposite sex?
We had regimental dances held in Penrith. The George Hotel was well patronised. On my 25th birthday, I took 11 other officers out for dinner. And I bought them a drink first. And it was in the days when there was a 5-bob limit on dinner. And most of them had a half lobster, I think. And I got change out of a fiver. Not that they, it was beer that they were drinking early on, you know. When they got the hard stuff, they were buying their own.
Did the mail come through from home quite often?
Yeah, that was a sore point with my parents and my then girlfriend and later wife, that it came more often from home than from me. I've still got some letters, and I'm forever apologising. And I don't think, when I was saying we've been up to our eyes, I didn't mean in the mud, I meant with work. And I don't think I was using it as an excuse. I think it was a true picture. We worked damned hard at this new effort. And it went right down the line.
Were there any rumours coming to you from time to time, or going through the unit from time to time, that you may be going abroad or you may be going into a fighting situation?
Well, it comes the next year when it was no longer 35th Independent Tank Brigade. It was 35th Army Tank Brigade, 79th Armoured Division, 21st Army Group.
And what date?
And, when? Major, I got a little note here which says 35th Independent Tank Brigade into 79th Armoured Division, 21 Army Group. Major General PCS Hobart, CBDSO OBEMC, visited the unit on the 23rd of April 1943 and addressed the unit on parade. And thereafter, the shoulder flash was the bull's head of the 79th Armoured Div. I think it was inherited from the bull, black bull on a yellow background, side view of a bull, which was the 11th Armored Division sign, which Hobo had also raised. So we just had the decapitated head as our shoulder flash from then.
Prior to this, had you had any high-ranking people coming to see you?
Quite a few. Which day was it? I can't remember which year it was. Cambrai Day. There was a fellow called Tiny Miller, VC, who'd been in the Battle of Cambrai. Came to the unit and talked to us. Between the other unit of the brigade, prior to Penrith, 151 RAC, who had been one of the original members, left the brigade and the 49th Royal Tanks took their place. And between them and ourselves, we had, but I cannot give you dates when, we had the King,